Okay, at this time, the chairperson should briefly qualify. Requirements to chair a meeting at the Central Orlando Group Saturday night speaker meeting are 1 year of continuous sobriety, have Central as your home group, and attend a group conscious meeting. I've met all those qualifications. My name is Marty. I'm an alcoholic. I came in here February 15th of 2008 and was given a little bit of hope. I was homeless at the time and some suggestions, got a sponsor, worked the steps, and through God's grace, I'm able to stand up here today. And that's going to be it for my qualification because of our speaker tonight. Now, before I introduce the speaker, the group's asked me to remind you to please make sure your cell phones are all off and to refrain from moving around or talking while the speaker is sharing. Now, our speaker, I've known Jim ever since I've came here. He actually knew me before I knew him. And he knew me when I was about yay big. I had no idea. He shares the same name as my father, and he also worked with my father. And he can probably tell you some of the crap that I used to do as a kid when I was at the warehouse throwing Cheetos in guys' hairs and stuff like that. I was a real butthead when I was a kid. It got worse when I started drinking. But anyways, Jim has a very strong message, and I'm just very fortunate to be able to call him one of my true friends today. And you came here to hear him and not me, so without further ado, here's Jim.
I'm a recovered alcoholic. My name is Jim Powers. Amen. And I'm going to do something different tonight. I'm going to dedicate this talk to my son who happens to be in the audience tonight. And I'm doing that because 12 and a half years ago, my alcoholism was so severe and so strong, and my self-centeredness was so out of control that I allowed him to be taken away from me and be moved two states away to be raised by another man. And he's forgiven me for doing that. He knows that I was sick. And tonight is all about recovery, not about a drunkalog. I'm going to get through this kind of quick because I know you're here for your coins and the cake and not to hear drunk. So, you know, I was born an alcoholic, and you all can determine for yourself whether you are or not. I was born on the 1st of April in 1954, and I don't know how many of you got your exact birth date in a song about a moonshiner and his son, but that was my exact birth date is Thunder Road, and that kind of set me off, I think. I was the fifth child out of six, born to a military commander. My father was not an alcoholic. My mother was not an alcoholic. My older three sisters were not alcoholic. My older brother stopped drinking to save his job and never came into the rooms and didn't want anything to do with spirituality. And he's a good friend of mine. He's up on my property and our property up in Georgia right now. And my little brother couldn't be here tonight. We moved all over the place, like any military family, but my father was really good at what he did, so we moved every couple of years. And we were in, the first time I can remember one of my problems, knowing that I was going to wind up somewhere, was in Japan. I was 6 years old, and I just got my training wheels on my bicycle, and my dad was a big film buff, so he was videotaping us, and you know, I was sticking my tongue out looking behind me and just pedaling down the street acting a fool, and I ran into the back of a police car. And for the next 14 years, police and I ran into each other quite a bit. We moved to Tacoma, Washington when my little brother was born. I was 10 years old. And it's kind of funny, I got to thinking about this the other day. You know, part of my disease was well under play way before I had a drink, because a couple of my friends and I were coming home from school, and we always cut through these woods, and we caught this little mouse. And we were playing with him in a little lunch bucket, and one of my friends got bit on the finger, and he took the mouse home with him, and this is a long time ago, people, so bear with me. And his mother called my mother and said, you know, did your son get bit too? And first thing that went through my mind when I was asked is, hey, this is a get out of school free card, you know. So I said yeah, and then I found out that I didn't get out of school free. I had to go have rabies shots. And at that time, there weren't rabies vaccination clinics everywhere. They had to cut the head off that mouse and send it to Washington, D.C. So out of 14 shots, I had to get 11 of them. And if you've never heard of the worst shot in the world, it's every day I got a rabies shot, and I just hated it. And that was just strictly because I was a liar. The next year we moved to Duluth, Minnesota. You know, got rabies before I got alcoholism. Go figure. The next year we moved to Duluth, Minnesota, and I was 11 years old. And my oldest sister got married. And at the reception, my father said that everybody could take a sip of the champagne to celebrate her getting married. And, you know, most normal drinkers would take a sip. And my sisters and my parents took a sip. And I gulped mine right down. I mean, I inhaled it. And I don't know anything about that golden moment or that magic moment or anything else. All I knew is I wanted to go back and have another one and another one and another one. And after I had about five, I was spinning around the room pretty good. And now they recognize me because now I'm, you know, acting a real fool. And I remember that they put me to bed, and the bed was spinning, and my head was spinning, and here we go. And I came to the next day, and I had vomit all over me. I peed on myself, and my head was killing me. And I couldn't wait to do it again. I couldn't wait to do it again. 2 years later, we moved to Florida, which to me was the first time my father had any intelligence, because when you live in Duluth, Minnesota, and you have to get up every morning and shovel the driveway so he can get out to the main road, that place was cold, people. I mean, cold. And we came down here, and the first thing I wanted to do is I wanted to find people just like me. And they were all a little bit older than me, 3 or 4 years older than me. I couldn't get the thought of getting drunk out of my mind. And that's what I did. I found people older than me that liked to get drunk like me. And the only way that I could do that was to steal. And so I became a burglar. Not a very good one, but good enough so I could get my alcohol. And I did that for a number of years. I spent the better part of 13, 14, and 15 in a little building on Michigan Street. It's called the Juvenile Detention Facility. I was an incorrigible, runaway alcoholic. And when my dad was in town, I was all right. He and I liked to fish, and I would do things with him, and I was okay. When he'd go out of town, and he did a lot, my mother could not control me, you know. And by this time, she's got a little baby and four older children than me, and so she just kept sticking me up there, and I don't blame her. I mean, I was out of control. 16 came along, and now I'm a burglar with a gun. I'm an armed robber, and I'm getting arrested. You know, there's a pattern y'all are going to hear here in a minute or two. I'm not sure when it's going to be, but I kept going. I was no longer going to juvenile detention. I was going to jail and getting bailed out and getting attorneys to get me off. And when I was 17, there was a major drug and alcohol and thievery ring busted. We made the front page of the Orlando Sentinel at the time. And there I was on the front page with my name, with about 16 felonies charged against me. And none of this, I'm telling you, that I'm proud at all. I'm just telling you what happened, because that's the way I grew up. I grew up seeking self-centeredness, and I was full of it. And I was full of it for a long time before I ever got here. And I'd like the newcomers to know that you don't have to take it as far as I took it. The people coming back, try to stay this time, because, you know, in the doctor's opinion, when it talks about emerging remorseful from a spree, you know, we don't always emerge. My son and I today were at a funeral for a friend of mine that drank himself to death, 61 years old. A month ago, a friend of mine that came in and out of this program for 15 years put a gun to his head. You know, this is a deadly disease, ladies and gentlemen, and it kills a lot of people. I begged my father to get me out of that last jam, and I was in jail for about a month, and he really didn't think he should do it. And I don't know if anybody here has ever said, "I'll never do it again, I'll never do it again, I'll never do it again." I wrote about 4 pages of "I'll never do it again," and he went and got some money from my grandmother. Both my grandfathers, I want you to know, were raging alcoholics. They were very violent and very mean when they were drunk. They were nice when they weren't drinking, but they were very mean. And I think that's why my mom and dad just, you know, just didn't want to do that type of thing. My mom became addicted to QVC later on, but nobody ever went to jail for buying too many plates. So, That was it on her. But anyway, my dad went ahead and got me out, and I was serious. I meant every word of what I said to him, that I was not going to do this anymore. I was going to stop doing all that stuff. I was going to move back home because I'd run away. And I meant it with all my heart. And so he posted the bail, and that night when he went to bed, my mother went to bed, I broke into his gun cabinet, and I stole the .45 automatic that he carried through three wars, and I took off on a spree from here to California. And I was 17 years old, and I wound up in California, and now I'm wanted for interstate flight to avoid prosecution along with everything else. And I know this is Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm a serious alcoholic. I believe in these traditions more than anybody. But when I grew up, drugs were a big part of my story. And a guy named Bill Oakley, who passed away sober and sponsored a lot of people, he said one time, you can't chase two rabbits with one dog. And being a redneck, I understood what that Kentucky pig farmer was talking about. You know, this is Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. But when I was in California, my friends dropped me off at a military hospital because I turned completely orange. I had serum hepatitis. And that's from dirty needles. And I spent about 3 months to 4 months in an isolation ward in a military hospital. I was wanted in Orlando. They had a wanted poster at the base, on the base PX wall, but the communication wasn't like it is now. They didn't have the database and everything else. So I recovered out in California enough to where I could get out of that hospital, and then went on a spree from California up to Minnesota, and from Minnesota back to Florida. And when I was 18, I came back to Florida to go to a party that a friend of mine was having. And apparently the police knew I was going to be at that party. And they came there specifically to arrest me. And they arrested a few other people, but they came to get me. And I had my second round of hepatitis. And I can tell you today, because I truly took that third step in 2002, that where it says, take away my difficulty, the victory over them may bear witness to those I might help. I have no hepatitis in my body today, and my doctor came out and explained that to you. And he doesn't say miracles. All he said to me is, I medically cannot explain how you have no enzymes in your body today. And I said, I think it's because I'm going to AA. And he knew I was going to AA too. You know, I've got a big red dot on my file which says, don't give him anything that'll get him high. My sobriety date is February 18, 2002. And what happened when I was arrested, I went before a judge, and because of all the felonies that I was facing, and because of my long string of career from a juvenile detention all the way up to there, the judge really didn't feel like I had much use for society. And at 18 years old, I was sentenced to 52 years in the state penitentiary in Rayford, Florida. And I want you to know something. I was afraid. I mean, I know about fear, but that was fear. And I was in an isolation cell at Orange County Jail, and the only book that I had in that cell was a Bible. And I prayed. And I prayed, and I prayed. Because I know an 18-year-old boy going to Rayford wasn't coming back the same. And I know now, looking back over my life, a friend of mine talks about looking in the rearview mirror, another one talks about connecting the dots behind you. I know that God was with me all that time. I know my higher power, who I call God, was with me all that time. Because 2 weeks later, that judge called me back in. And I don't know if my parents had something to do with it. I never found out. But he said, I'm going to give you another chance. I'm going to send you 18 months on the Orange County chain gang. And that's exactly what I got, was 18 months on a chain gang. And let me tell you, back in 1972, Orange County had a chain gang. They had just removed the chains off of the feet. But it was the same as if you watched the movie Cool Hand Luke. We did the same things. We got up before dawn in the back of a truck every day. And it was slave labor until dark, and we did that 6 days a week. And I was a puny, skinny, pale punk when I got out there. And I fell out for the first 2 weeks, and when you fell out, they threw you underneath the truck until the day was over. They didn't call 911 and send you to the hospital. It was true punishment. And then, you know, I deserved it. I deserved more. But I'm glad that's all they gave me. But I also knew something else. I knew how to make something before I even got that, because of all the friends I was hanging out with. And I knew that being in a prison farm, you're feeding everybody yourself. 150 prisoners and guards. I didn't want to be on the road, so I was a real good boy. A lot of people didn't like trustees at that time, and I didn't really care. I wanted to get off the road as fast as I could and get in the kitchen. And the reason I wanted to get in the kitchen was two: one, it wasn't as hot, and two, there were ingredients in the kitchen that I knew that you could put together in a can and you could hide it on the top shelf, and after a couple weeks, it's called buck. It's illegal beer. It's what you make by using stuff that is in the kitchen. And yeah, you know, here I am thinking, how can I get alcohol? You know, sickness. The sickness was there, no matter if I had it or not. And I want you to know that when I got here years later, the doctor's opinion hooked me, because we used rotten grapefruit in that mixture, and it was the nastiest stuff you ever had in your life. And to this day, I joke, I don't know if we drained it through a clean sock or a dirty sock. It didn't matter. When you drank it, you got the effect. And I drank for effect from day one. I never drank for taste. And that's why it's in the doctor's opinion that men and women drink, essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. And that hooked me. I got off probation. I moved to a little town in Mississippi and met my future ex-wife. But we were married for 21 years. And I really didn't ever know about Alcoholics Anonymous. My parents didn't talk about Alcoholics Anonymous. They didn't talk much about their fathers. And so I didn't think I was abnormal, because I didn't drink in the morning. I didn't hide bottles. I didn't wear a trench coat. I had all this misconception about alcoholics. But every day when I got off of work, I started going home with a bunch of Schlitz malt liquor. When I wound up home, I'd have the cheapest whiskey at the house, and you know, and I would drink to be drunk every night. And I've said it more than one time that probably the only two things I never did was murder and rape. But I also know what a conscious blackout is, and I just pray to God that I never did either one of those, because if you don't know what a conscious blackout is, you haven't drank enough yet. It's where you wake up in the morning after you pass out and you wonder how the crystal bags are on the counter. You know, you got up during the night and you drove to Crystal. You know, and that's how a lot of people get killed, is somebody's driving in a conscious blackout. I got a job where drinking was, you know, part of the deal. But my father taught me well, and we became good friends after all that time in the, you know, my youth. And so I went to work every day. I was pretty hungover. But I was there every day at work, and I made good money. I was in the real estate industry, and I did well. I got a lot of accolades, and for those of you who don't know, in the real estate industry, it's the number one industry to promote your ego. You know, you want your paper, your name in the paper, you want your face in the paper, you're always telling everybody how good you are. And some of my friends are real estate brokers, and I'm not talking to you right now, so don't quit nodding. But that's what kept me from accepting this program when I first got here. When we were married 17 years, my son was born. And the only thing I ever wanted in life was a boy, you know. She lost a couple babies due to some ectopic pregnancies between that time. But my alcoholism was just going out of control. And I never drank in front of my son. I don't believe he ever saw me drunk, but one time when I was on a relapse, and he knew I was coming to AA, and it really broke his heart that I was actually drinking. But it was one of those times where I had stopped coming to AA, had stopped, never had started getting a sponsor or working the program. I was just coming to meetings. And I never planned on coming here in the first place. But what happened was, I started having some back problems, and I started taking some, my sister who passed away from a bone marrow disease, she had some Percocets. And this is where a little bit of drugs come into the program here. And, you know, I drank as hard as I could, and now I'm taking, you know, codeine. And there comes a time where your mind and your bladder don't cooperate anymore. Yeah. Your bladder says get up at 2:30 in the morning. Your mind says no, I'm sleeping. And the next thing I know, my wife's going, "You're peeing all over me. You're peeing all over me." And the first time it happened, I really felt ashamed. You know, I wasn't. This that was not planned, and it wasn't. I mean, I didn't. I wasn't into water sports then or now, but. I went out the next day and spent $250 on a brand new mattress, and she went out and spent $20 on a plastic mattress cover. She was smarter than I was, because it happened again. And the third time it happened, she moved into another bedroom, and shortly thereafter, she was pretty much done with me. And I was pretty much done with her, because my alcoholism had taken over full-blown at that time. She had gone to talk to my father and my stepmother about what was happening, and I knew that when my father married my stepmother that she had retired from the Hillsborough County court system. I just never asked her what she did. And she was the lady that the judges would send DUI drivers to determine how many times you had to come to AA to get the piece of paper signed. Small world, right?
Yeah.
And she looked me in the eyes and said, "You need to go to Alcoholics Anonymous, and your wife needs to go to Al-Anon." And my wife said, "I don't have a problem." And I said, "I'm not an alcoholic. I mean, those people are underneath the bridge. I'm living in a house on a lake, two cars in the driveway, you know, money in the bank. I tend to be an alcoholic." Well, a few weeks later, a friend of mine who was about 4 years younger than me was tough loved out of his house, and he was told, "Don't come home if you're drinking anymore." And a lot of us have heard that. And so he committed suicide. He set his car on fire and burned himself up on a back road in Volusia County. And at his funeral, I made a promise to God that I'd come to one AA meeting. Bear with me. To come to one AA meeting to tell you that if you didn't quit drinking, you alcoholics were going to kill yourself. I walk into Central, there's people with 30 years sobriety in there, and I'm bursting out in tears saying, "If you don't quit drinking, you know, how sick is that? You know? And you guys weren't wearing trench coat, and you didn't smell like vomit. You were just normal people." I had no clue. Nobody had ever told me about Alcoholics Anonymous. And there's a little girl there patting me on the shoulder saying, "It's going to be all right." Yeah, that was in 98. And I told you I didn't get sober until 2002. And I walked out of that meeting that day, and that was the only meeting I was going to go to, because I made a promise to God, and I believe in God. I believe very strongly today in God, my God. And I hope each one of you has one, because I know the hand of God's in this room today right now. So if you're a real alcoholic on a Saturday night and you're not drinking, you've been touched by the hand of God.
Amen.
I walked out of the meeting, and a guy stalked me down the street. My office is right across the street down here. And this guy came out behind me, 90 miles an hour. "Hey, man, keep coming back. You know, you don't have to live like that." He told me all the sayings in about 2 seconds or less. And I turned around and told him I'm going to have him arrested if he doesn't quit stalking me, you know. And to this day, I cannot tell you why I walked into a new meeting the next day, except it was the grace of God trying to get me sober. And I didn't get sober for 27 days. 27 days, I walked into this room at noon. It was a much smaller room, let me tell you. We had a little house on the corner over there. And for some reason, the chair people always wanted to pick on me to share because they wanted to hear me cry. And 27 days, I cried, "I can't quit drinking," you know. And I was trying then, but by the time I got home every night, I was drinking and I was drunk. And, you know, get a sponsor, work the steps. That was going right over my head. All I was hearing is keep coming back. And there was a gentleman there that I don't know if he liked me or hated me. I can't tell you which one it was right now. But on that 27th day, it was a Friday, and afterwards he took me aside and he said, his name was Leo. took me aside and he said, "Why don't you just go home and drink a bottle of arsenic? I'm tired of seeing you kill yourself slowly." And for the first time in almost 30 years, I didn't take a drink and I didn't have a drug that night. And I started my sobriety on a resentment. And that's not the way you're supposed to start it, I assure you. But that old man helped so many people. And he knew when it was right time to pluck that little feather off of that pigeon and just say something. And I came in the next day and I picked up a white chip. But I didn't get a sponsor. I used the group as my sponsor. I did pray. I did ask God to relieve me of the obsession. But I never, ever got rid of that lingering thought in the back of my mind that I could drink again. I never thought I could drink like a gentleman because I never did. But in the back of my mind, I thought I could drink again. And every 3 months, every 4 months, I'd just decide to have a drink and I'd be off to the races. And we didn't pass out envelopes at that time. People got your phone number and, you know, my phone would be ringing. And they used to tell me that AA will screw up your drinking. And I'm thinking, yeah, you go to AA, you stop drinking, and it screws up your drinking. You get a belly full of booze and a head full of AA, let me tell you, it's no fun. It's no fun at all listening to your answering machine and people from your home group are sitting there calling, seeing if you're alive, because they haven't seen you for a couple of weeks or a month. And drinking was no fun. And I would come back, and I would pick up another white chip. And that happened for 3.5 years. In and out, killing myself slowly. And I came to a speaker meeting, and a guy got up here and told my story. I mean, actually told my story, including drinking Slitz malt liquor, and I didn't think anybody else drank that stuff. I mean, nobody could do that. And afterwards, the guy who brought me to the meeting said, "Why don't you go meet this guy?" And I was like, you know, I'd gone 9 months without a drink. I didn't think I needed a sponsor. I didn't think I needed anybody. It'd been 9 months. I picked up a chip that night. In all honesty, I'd gone 9 months just, you know, without drinking, praying, sponsoring myself, which is not recommended because, you know, you just a sick person sponsoring a sick person. And I went and met this gentleman. And I went up and shook his hand and said, "You know, I really like what you had to share. And you know, would you sponsor me?" And he qualified me really quick. He said, "Are you done drinking?" And I said, "Yeah, I'm done. I'm really sure I'm done." And here's another one of those miracles. I took out my business card, and on the white side on the back of it, I wrote down my phone number, and I handed it to him, and I said, "Why don't you call me Monday if you want to sponsor me?" He's here tonight rolling his eyes again, I'm sure. He took out his business card, and on the white side, he wrote down his phone number and said, "If you want me to sponsor you, call me Monday morning." And we turned those two business cards over and we worked for the same company in two different divisions. I had never met the man before in my life, and he worked in the same company that I did. And I knew that was the hand of God right then. And the next day was Sunday, and for no reason whatsoever, I stopped and bought a half gallon of whiskey. For no reason. I have no clue. And when I came to Monday morning, I was laying on my kitchen floor. I was bloodied. I had puke and pee again all over me, and half that bottle was gone, and I had no clue what happened. I remember I poured one drink and had no clue what happened after that. And I knew that man probably wasn't going to sponsor me, because it says in the book that if you're not done drinking, we need to move on to somebody else. And I believe very strongly in the Alcoholics Anonymous program and in what's written in this book. But I called him, you know, and he could hear the desperation in my voice. And he said, "Jim, pour out the rest of that booze, go to your noon meeting, pick up a white chip, and we'll meet afterwards." And the man's name's Joe, and he's here tonight. I told him, I said, I'll break down more than once, but I believe he saved my life through the grace of God. Because that day we worked the first three steps, and I was done drinking. And I believed in this program. I needed a guide. I needed a guide to walk me through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And one of the things I've learned since then is that when you hear, you know, the first 164 pages, I mean, that's really true. They have not changed the first 164 pages since the book was written in 1939. But there's four chapters. There's four chapters after the 12 steps. So I don't need to worry about the chapter to the wives, to the employer, the family afterwards, and there's no vision for me if I don't do what's in the first 103 pages. And that's the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's where you'll find them. The doctor's opinion hooked me. In the first 47 pages, three times, there's an asterisk telling you to go to the back of the book and read the spiritual experience. And so what I tell my guys is you don't have to worry about the wives or anything else, because none of that's going to matter if you don't implement these 12 steps into your life on a daily basis. And it is a one day at a time program. And I've been sober since 2002, and it is by the grace of God. And when you hear that sometimes, you think that everybody in the world that's sober now says it. Well, the reason they say it is because it's in the book. I was beyond any human help. It says it in the ABCs. You know, I was beyond any human help whatsoever. I needed a power greater than myself. I needed to believe that God, there was a real God out there, and there is. You know, I can't show Him to you. I can't prove Him to you. But I can tell you that if you're willing to believe, I can assure you, you can have a life beyond your wildest dreams. On my 9th anniversary, one of my sponsors, and I have four sponsors today, not one, so you can tell I probably need a little upkeep or something. But one of my sponsors gave me a coin that says, Dare to Dream. And you know, when I was sober about 6 years, I had this dream. And some of you know about the dream, you know, it wasn't Martin Luther King's dream, but I dreamed of moving to Georgia. You know, that's where I was born. I dreamed of moving back up there and buying a couple acres, because I went up there every year because I like to hunt. And what God gave me was 50 acres, not a couple. And I got my dream. And, you know, I used to come into here, because we had moved over here by now, and every day at noon people would hear about Jim's dream. You know, I got my dream, you know. And they finally said, well, go, you know, we're tired of hearing about your dream. But before I left, a guy came by me and said, get another dream. And, you know, he kind of ticked me off, because I liked the guy, and I didn't understand what he was saying, get another dream. And what he was telling me is I was limiting God. I was limiting God to one dream only. You know, Bill Oakley also said, bring your dreams, even your drunk dreams, to Alcoholics Anonymous and see what happens. Well, I got that dream. Beyond my wildest imagination, I got that 50 acres and I moved to Georgia. And it was great, except, A, I missed all of y'all, and so I was in communication down here on a regular basis, like daily, because the closest meeting to me was 9 miles away. And they talked about cotton seed and tractors. I'm way out in the woods in Georgia, let me just tell you. And finally, I found a meeting in Albany, Georgia, which is 60 miles one way away from my house. And it was called Central Albany. It was started 1 year before this group was started. And they had closed meetings. They had literature meetings. And so I would drive over there 3 or 4 times a week. You know, when people say, what lengths were you willing to go to stay sober? You know, will you drive 120 miles to have a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous? Would I drive 120 miles to have a drink? Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. And so I made that my secondary home group up in Georgia. And then I talked to somebody and he said, you know, if you don't like the meeting that's close to you, why don't you do something about it? And so now I go to that meeting on a regular basis when I'm up there, and I carry my big book into the meeting. And even though there's only one alcoholic in that meeting and there's a lot of people from treatment centers, we still have an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. And it's the greatest thing in the world. Because I know one day, I don't know when it's going to be, that there won't be a pure alcoholic left. Well, let me tell you something. Alcohol is a drug anyway. Dr. Bob and Bill use narcotics. but this is a singleness of purpose program, and the only reason that we're still here 76 years later is because we stick to the singleness of purpose. Every other program that tried to help alcoholics, from the Washingtonians to the Oxford group, had other agendas, and they all fractured and died. And so I don't talk about drugs, you know, not inside the room. I can tell you a bunch of things I did outside the room, but in here I focus on talking about my recovery from alcoholism, my recovery from that hopeless state of body and mind, being a recovered alcoholic, like the book says. You know, I believe very strongly in this program, and this program has saved my life and has given me a life beyond my wildest dreams. And I have more dreams today than I ever had in my entire life. You know, I fill them up. I was up in Georgia for a couple of years. I had done the smartest thing I'd ever done. I invested in a real estate company, opened it right before the market crashed. So I wasn't making any money up in Georgia. And let me tell you about the fellowship. You know, the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous will love you when you don't love yourself. If you get a home group and you let people get to know you, they will love you until you can learn how to love yourself. And that's what happened with me at Central. I was up there, and I got a phone call one day. And my brother, who was 10 years younger than me, went into the emergency room and went into a coma. And I got a phone call that said that, you know, he was in a coma, and he might not come out of it. And my little brother had 5 DUIs, and he was one of us. And he came to a couple of meetings, and he picked up a couple of white chips. But he said, I just can't do that spiritual way of life thing. And so I said, I'll be right down there. And I was going to jump in my car and drive down here right away. And the person said, I'm a friend of Bill W's, and I've heard you talk. And that's a fellowship. I didn't know this person at all, but I knew I had somebody watching out for my brother. A couple days later, I came down and started handling my brother's affairs for him. We made a bucket list of all the things that he wanted to do, because what they did, he's had 10 tumors because he didn't take care of himself. I know, as an alcoholic, I never went to the doctor. I never went to the dentist. A lot of these teeth that you see in my mouth are not mine. Because I went to the dentist after I got sober, and they said, your teeth aren't any good anymore. But he was given 6 months to 2 years to live. And he was wearing a monitoring bracelet at the time. And it wasn't one for GPS. It was one to monitor your sweat glands, which I had never heard of. And all he wanted was that bracelet off. And he hadn't had a drink in over a year. And so I went to the probation and parole department with him, and I gave him all the paperwork that said that, you know, he doesn't have long to live. And they cut that bracelet off. They said he has no more probation, no more parole, nothing. He's free to go. And we were going to do this bucket list for about 3 months, and then he was going to come up there and die at my place in Georgia. Because he had accepted that he was going to die. And I had too, because I had talked to the doctors. And that day, we stopped by here. He came to a noon meeting. He made it for about a half hour in here, and then he wanted to go get some lunch, and he wanted just a glass of wine. And I just said, you know, I'm not going to tell you no, you know, but really, we got all these things to do. And he had a glass of wine with lunch, and then asked me to stop by the ABC on the way, taking him back to his house so he could buy a bottle of wine. And in less than 30 days, he blew an ulcer out. And I got a phone call, and I rushed down here, and I held my little brother's hand while he died at the age of 44 years old. It's a deadly disease, you know? But the horror of it, when you're holding your brother's hands, you'll never forget it. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, some of the things that you all taught me, some of the things my first sponsor, my new sponsor, my spiritual advisor, my service sponsor, all these people taught me to grow up. You know, because I wasn't very grown up when I finally got sober. I was still 11 years old, apparently. 12? Maybe. They told me to be responsible. Be a responsible member of society again. That's what the book tells me to do. You know, working these 12 steps, it says at the end of in step 12 that I'm to carry this message to the alcoholic that still suffers. And in the big book on page 77, it talks about I'm to be of maximum service to God and my fellows. It doesn't just limit me to alcoholics. It tells me to be a responsible member inside and outside these rooms. And I do try to carry this message. I owe a debt of gratitude that I can never repay to Alcoholics Anonymous. You taught me to be responsible at my job, to show up for work on time, to actually earn a paycheck. You taught me to be responsible with my love. I always thought I knew about love, but until I came in here and I saw how sober alcoholics treat each other with pure love for their fellow human beings, with nothing in return, asking nothing for this thing. To give away this program for free and for fun. That's true love. And you taught me how to be responsible to my home group. You know, Central's my home group. It's the best group in the world. I'm just going to tell you that. It's also the oldest group in Orlando. It was the first group formed. There's 129 groups now in Orlando. 429 meetings a week. So when somebody tells me I can't get to a meeting, I tell them you're lying. And I come to a lot of meetings today because I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love to give back what was so freely given to me. He told me to be responsible in all my affairs, to practice these principles in all my affairs. And then they told me to be responsible to Alcoholics Anonymous as a whole. And today I am responsible. I'm responsible that when anyone, anywhere reaches out their hand for help, I want the hand of AA to always be there. And for that, I am responsible. Thanks for letting me share.